Welcome to Outdoor by Four Magazine's audio edition of Issue 53. For those unfamiliar with Outdoor by Four, the magazine began its journey as a fully independent, vehicle-based adventure and outdoors lifestyle publication in 2013. Since that time, Outdoor by Four has been the catalyst for expanding the reach of overland and vehicle-based adventure travel into the outdoors market, with a focus not only in the mode of travel, whether a 4x4, motorcycle, bicycle, or by foot, but also in the adventures themselves and the people who live them. In this issue, you'll hear a sampling of stories from Outdoor by Four's print edition, including Behind the Redwood Curtain, a journey through Northern California along the Redwood Coast Adventure Trail, Otter the Overlander, a 1965 Volkswagen bus and its transformation back to its former glory, Gearing Up, the history and how-to of Ural's world-class side hack, and last, a field review of Oregon Trailer's flagship off-road teardrop trailer. There are also a variety of additional stories in this issue you can read by picking up a copy or by subscribing and receiving a copy as part of your subscription order at www.outdoorx4.com. We hope you enjoyed this issue of Outdoor by Four Magazine. The Dispatch by Frank Ludwell, Editor-in-Chief. A few months ago, I went through the process of building a new computer system for my office, as the old system I had been using was nearly as old as Outdoor by Four, dating back to 2014. During the process of backing up and reloading an enormous library of content from the old system and our office network, I came across a batch of photos from the first overland-style trip I took with my best friend while exploring in a Jeep TJ Rubicon I had purchased a few years after graduating from college. Comparing it to the hundreds of vehicle-based trips I've been on since, it was undoubtedly one of the most memorable and most simplistic. When my friend Richard and I planned out our jaunt to West Texas's Big Bend region, the only significant considerations were cost and time. We hadn't been out of school but a handful of years, and with Richard and his wife having recently had a baby, and I being constrained with a job that required a good amount of responsibility with limited vacation time, we both stretched every dollar possible and days we had for travel with limited means while still getting the most from the experience. At the time, there were three rooftop tent companies being offered in the US: Auto Home, Easy On, and Howling Moon. There was only one off-road specific trailer company, formerly known as Adventure Trailers and now known as AT Overland, and the overland market itself didn't have a name. Most everyone I knew used what we used on that first trip in packing up and loading their vehicle for self-sufficient adventure, including plastic bins for storage, a simple two-burner stove for meal prep, our backpacking gear, such as Jetboil headlamps and lightweight clothing, and a ground tent with a ground cloth. We didn't bother with camp chairs because there weren't any we could afford that were compact or small enough to fit into the limited cargo area of the two-door Jeep. In short, we kept it simple out of necessity, and looking back, simplicity is what made the experience as enjoyable and as memorable as it was. The narrative now has become you need the latest and greatest, whether it's a truck that costs nearly as much as a house or enough gear to support a small village while traveling to a remote destination that's unrealistic for the masses. YouTube, social media, and large event series have created a culture and environment in which anyone who isn't into overland is intimidated to go out and explore as Richard and I did for fear they can't afford it or that a simplistic approach isn't what overland is. The fact is, the overland market has created a monster within itself, and the narrative has been perpetuated to the extent the impact has resulted in hundreds of companies offering the same product and oftentimes doing so by stealing the work of those who set the foundation in place to begin with. That's also not considering the media outlets, including Outdoor by Four, who have played our role in coalescing to this message rather than getting back to what overland is truly all about: camaraderie and responsible exploration of the areas traveled to, and doing so thoughtfully and as simply as possible in the vehicle you already have. So, the next time you're left thinking you can't overland unless you have every bit of product that's out there, think otherwise. Some of the greatest and most memorable experiences you may ever have might very well be those where friendship and being in the moment are all that you need. Since 2017, 23Zero has been a leader in the ever-evolving overland market. Whether it's high-quality products such as rooftop tents, awnings, or a variety of camp life gear, 23Zero is all about delivering adventure with a made-better principle, opting on better products, not cheaper ones. If you're looking for quality gear to get you into the backcountry and back, look no further than 23Zero. Visit them at www.23zero.com.
Behind the Redwood Curtain, words and photos, Ben Easley. These kings of the forest, the noblest of a noble race. That's how John Muir once referred to the coast redwoods of Central and Northern California. Growing to nearly 400 feet in height and clinging to a narrow band of coastline from Southern Oregon to Big Sur, only 5% of the original old-growth redwood forest remains. Renowned for their record-breaking height, coast redwoods are also some of the largest and oldest trees on Earth. Reputed big tree hunters like Mario Vaden and Cal Poly Humboldt's Stephen Sillett, PhD, now believe there are living coast redwoods larger than their giant sequoia cousins in the Sierra Nevada. Historical evidence supports their claims, as the official measurements of the Crenel Creek Giant, felled 1905, easily exceed the total volume of the record-setting General Sherman tree by 17% to 25%. The tallest and largest trees can be found in far northern California among the remaining old-growth forests of Del Norte, Humboldt, and Mendocino counties. Upon leaving the sun-draped hills and vineyards of Sonoma County, the Redwood Coast creates a brooding and impressive presence. The wet season typically arrives by mid-fall, and it's not uncommon for the rains to continue into June. While the wine country may be basking in 90-degree temperatures in June, the Redwood Coast may be experiencing torrential downpours. When the wet season gives way to the dry summer months, redwoods get their water from the air, receiving up to 40% of their annual water intake from fog. Locals have long referred to the region as the Redwood Curtain, named for how the dense, towering forests seem to isolate this area from the rest of the state. The people who live here are often seen as quirky and fiercely independent, thriving in this mist-shrouded, secluded landscape. Giants of the North State. Crescent City is a hard-knock, blue-collar town where fishing remains a vital industry. Beyond the rusted boats and crab pots lies the ominous redwood forest. Hills and mountains of seemingly endless conifers stretch for miles in all directions. The Redwood Coast Adventure Trail, a 472-mile overland track developed by Overland Trail Guides, starts out with a bang on its northern end. Our group of five rigs embarked on the Red Cat by traveling Howland Hill Road, a 10-mile dirt road through some of the most awe-inspiring old-growth forests in the North State region. For those willing to venture on foot, the short hikes to Stout Grove or the newly accessible Grove of Titans are well worth the effort. We made the 1.5-mile hike to the latter along a metal-graded boardwalk. The grove features four of the 10 largest known coast redwoods on Earth. With names like Lost Monarch, Screaming Titans, and Chesty Puller, it's hard to resist the appeal of visiting this majestic grove. A few miles down the road from Howland Hill lies Forks of Smith, where the South Fork of the Smith River converges with the main fork. This often overlooked spot is one of the hidden gems of the Redwood Coast. A 5-minute hike leads visitors to a rocky point where the forks meet. The Smith is renowned for its clear, emerald waters and is said to have some of the cleanest water in the lower 48. Leaving the Smith behind, our group ventured deeper into the mountains of the Smith River National Recreation Area, taking in the views of the Del Norte coastline and rugged Klamath Mountains to the east. From here, our group would head south along Highway 101 to Gold Bluffs Beach to camp for the night. Before we reached the beach, we stopped to snap photos with Paul Bunyan and his Blue Ox Babe at Trees of Mystery and drove the short 5-mile gravel loop of Coastal Drive, which features impressive views of the Klamath River mouth. If you're lucky, you may catch members of the Yurok tribe spearfishing or smoking salmon along the banks of the mighty Klamath, a sacred waterway to local indigenous people since time immemorial. Gold Bluffs Beach Campground, a quaint area that sits between the dunes of the beach and the bluff for which it's named, is easily one of my favorite developed campgrounds in California. For whatever reason, this section of coastline seems to be drenched in sunshine when much of the coast to the north and south is enveloped in a dense layer of fog, and it was no different for this trip. There's nothing quite like falling asleep to the sound of the crashing surf in the distance. from surf to snowdrifts. The following day, we awoke bright and early with plans to drive through Prairie Creek Redwoods, Redwood National Park, and then Hoopa Tribal Lands on our way to camp. We departed Gold Bluffs with the California sunshine on our backs, a bit of an oddity given the number of storms that continue to pound the North State in the first week of spring. On our way to hike the trail to Big Tree, a small herd of Roosevelt elk congregated at a popular viewing spot in Prairie Creek Redwoods. Weighing up to 1,200 pounds each, we reveled at the magnificent beasts that once numbered in the hundreds of thousands in the dense forests of the Pacific Northwest. Like many of the state parks along the Redwood Coast, Prairie Creek is filled with a number of fantastic hiking opportunities, with the Fern Creek Trail being its most popular. Unfortunately, the gate leading to the trailhead was closed, so we opted to make the short hike to Big Tree, a mammoth redwood that's nearly 24 feet in diameter. Back in our vehicles, we began the ascent up Bald Hills Road, Redwood National Park, stopping for lunch just below Schoolhouse Peak. We ate lunch as the wind howled over the ridgetop. A 5-minute hike to the top of Schoolhouse Peak reveals an old fire lookout and impressive views of the snow-capped coastal range and Klamath Mountains if the conditions are right. We pushed beyond the boundaries of Redwood National Park and into Hoopa Tribal Lands. The desolate forest roads that followed Bald Hills Road seemed empty. Clouds crept in, and the sunshine was soon muted by gray skies. That's when we hit our first deadfall. I was able to easily clear the first few downed trees, but they grew more frequent and larger in size. We finally encountered a tree so precariously slid downslope that it ate into our planned travel time. After 90 minutes of winching and chainsaw work, the stubborn tan oak was cleared from the road. A few miles from camp, we hit our first patch of snow at just over 3,000 feet in elevation. Apparently, a recent storm from the Gulf of Alaska had dumped several feet of snow on these mountain roads that typically only see a dusting or two during the winter months. The snow grew deeper, and I eventually found my truck high-centered. After drastically airing down the tires and some quick winching, I was free and on the move, only to encounter several more snowdrifts that grew increasingly deeper. Short on daylight, we regrouped and determined the best way to get to camp would be to reroute through the town of Hoopa and up and over Bear Road, a well-traveled dirt road connecting Hoopa to the Eureka area. The reroute paid off quickly as we were at our campsite within 45 minutes of turning around. Here comes the rain. We awoke the next morning to the sound of light rain. By the time we'd packed camp, precipitation had transformed into a torrent of water falling from the sky. We hurried away in our iron stagecoaches, climbing into the mist-covered slopes of Humboldt County. Our day started with exploring the old dirt ranch roads of the Neyland area, one of the original cattle and sheep farming regions of the North State. If you ever get the chance to visit the back roads of Humboldt and Mendocino counties during springtime, you're in for quite the treat. Even under gray skies and rain, the oak-studded green hills contrasting with the evergreen forest create a breathtaking landscape. You might find yourself pinching yourself, wondering if you've wandered onto a Lord of the Rings movie set. After 4 hours of solid rain, we made a beeline into Fortuna to dry off and for a warm bite at Eel River Brewing Company. Peering out the windows of the brewery, we saw the clouds beginning to break. We were off to the Lost Coast, a famed slice of California coastline that's experienced little development since the arrival of settlers nearly 200 years ago. Rays of sunshine crept in as we climbed the dirt of Bear River Ridge, which ends at Matole Road, a spectacular stretch of pockmarked pavement along the Lost Coast, featuring some of the most impressive coastal views in the lower 48. After reaching the coastal hamlet of Petrolia, Matole Road turns inland. Scattered showers greeted us as we arrived at the local county park. On the other side of our camp, the banks of the normally clear Matole River swelled a milky brown. It turned out that we were the only ones crazy enough to endure the inclement weather. As the evening turned to nightfall, the rain showers transformed from intermittent to non-stop. Party of One. After 12-plus hours of steady rainfall, our group of 5 rigs was down to 2. 3 of the guys in our group decided to head home rather than endure another day of rain. Our now 2-truck convoy maneuvered along the wet roads of the Matole River Valley, climbing over the High Point and dropping into Humboldt Redwoods State Park. Whenever I visit Humboldt Redwoods, I try to hit the Bull Creek Flats Forest, the densest known biomass on Earth. It also contains the largest concentration of 350-foot tall trees on Earth. Having the forest to yourself amid the fog and light rain is a spiritual experience that's hard to replicate. From Humboldt Redwoods, we traveled through the heart of the Emerald Triangle, where the domestic marijuana industry gained a foothold in California back in the 1970s. We traversed the dense forests of Dyerville Loop, bringing us to the higher elevations along Bell Springs Road. Climbing higher into the clouds, our visibility was limited to less than half a mile, but like the stretches of road near Neyland and Bear River Ridge, the scenery was awe-inspiring. The dirt of Bell Springs intersects with Highway 101 just north of Laytonville. In town, I said goodbye to the fourth departing member of the group. Now it was just me and my trusty dog, Shasta. We followed the highway until it led us to Jackson Demonstration Forest. The big blue Ram maneuvered through the tight and twisty dirt roads of the Redwood Forest, eventually spilling onto Highway 1. Strangely enough, the clouds remained, but there was no rain. We made the quick loop around the seaside village of Mendocino before jumping across the highway to Big River Beach, the official end of the route. Shasta playfully galloped along the sand, pridefully puffing her chest out. To say we were content with our journey would be quite the understatement. Sidebar. Redwood Coast Adventure Trail, aka Red Cat. The Redwood Coast Adventure Trail is a 472-mile-long overland track developed by Overland Trail Guides. Running north to south from Crescent City to the seaside village of Mendocino, the route visits many of the well-known California state and national parks along the way, but it also navigates through lesser-traveled dirt backroads of the Redwood Coast familiar only to locals. The route is accessible to 4x4s and all-wheel drive vehicles of all sizes. For more information about the Red Cat, visit overlandtrailguides.com.
Otter the Overlander, Jason Smurthwaite's 1965 Volkswagen bus. Words by Eric Arnold. After years of seeing the shell of a 1965 11-window Volkswagen bus sitting on railroad ties outside a Utah storage building, Jason Smurthwaite would ultimately parlay restoration of the owner's 1970 camper and trade for the older body. This would lead him down the path of not only owning his first split-window bus, but he would also build a tribute to the family who once owned it. Lynn Ottinger began giving tours through the Utah Canyonlands in 1960. Southeastern Utah Taxi Service, renamed later to Lynn Ottinger's Tours, was the first tour company of its kind. He used a fleet of VW buses to ferry tourists through the mostly uncharted region. 10 pre-1967 buses comprised the entire fleet, with 8 being in use during much of the 1970s and 80s when Lynn retired. Years after, one of the original 10 buses was restored by KCW in Colorado, which prompted a get-together of VWs for a celebratory off-road tour through the backcountry surrounding Moab. The gathering, known as the Ottinger Caravan, became an annual event. During its second year, Jason Smurthwaite once again gazed upon the shell of the 65. I hopped into the 21-window tour bus and we headed to the warehouse to see all the original Ottinger tour buses in their glory, said Smurthwaite. As we were getting closer, I knew exactly where we were heading, to the location of the white split bus I had seen years earlier. I had driven past it before, and you could only notice it if you looked at just the right moment. Smurthwaite had no idea it was the same location as the original tour buses. Around the campfire that evening, Lynn Ottinger's son, Sonny, explained an arrangement Lynn and a friend had made regarding another bus, a 1970 camper. An engine build was necessary. Smurthwaite reached out to the friend to see if there was anything he could do to help get the 70 camper on the road. The friend revealed he may not be able to complete the project and asked if Jason wanted to take the reins. At this moment, Smurthwaite said, I realized this might be my only chance to own a split bus. He agreed to complete the build and trade for the shell of the white 65. The 70 camper was completed in 5 months and delivered to Lynn a week before his 90th birthday. The inside was full of sand and debris, the transmission and rear deck lid were missing, and the front spindles were gone, Smurthwaite recalled about the condition of the 65 as it sat outside Ottinger's warehouse. The body was very straight, though it suffered from some rust in the rockers, floor, and cross members. Smurthwaite, along with his dad and Sonny Ottinger, loaded the bus onto the trailer for the trip back to Salt Lake City. The first order of business was to strip off the white paint, which had been sprayed on at an unknown date. Smurthwaite removed the white layer and exposed the original sealing wax red and beige-gray combination, which, remarkably, almost completely survived underneath. The original paint was in too great of shape to repaint it, Smurthwaite said. I wanted to show the decades of wear and tear and keep the amazing story it shows. I touched up the areas of repair and a few spots that were sanded down to bare metal. The underside of the bus was cleaned and blasted. Three-stepped POR-15 was applied, which was covered with primer, and then color-matched Raptor liner was applied to the undercarriage and lower rockers. The bus was christened Otter the Overlander, in homage to the Ottinger family and their history. I was told this bus had been used on occasion as a fill-in when all the tours were full or a bus was needing repair, Smurthwaite said. He had traced the original logos from the bus he restored for the family, the second of the original tour buses to be restored, and had planned to paint them on his own build. I decided not to do the tour logos, but to create my own logos using the same letters from the tour bus. Therefore, the Otter logos reference the original style. This bus was rebuilt for strength and longevity. Smurthwaite took his inspiration for the off-road aspects of the build from a lifetime of camping and owning buses and off-roading in Baja races. The suspension was raised for more clearance. The original beam was cut and made adjustable. Smurthwaite also drilled the spot welds and cut the engine cradle to lower it 1.25 inches to run a Beetle nose cone and gain more height and move the spring plates down. At the corners are BFG MT tires, 215-75R15s on Wolfsburg West 15-inch stock wheels. Behind them, for more stopping power, are Type E Motorsports disc brakes using large Chevrolet calipers and cross-drilled slotted and vented rotors. Under the deck lid is a blueprinted and balanced 2180cc engine built by Smurthwaite himself. I wanted to create a simple stroker engine with thick wall cylinders to help with the heat and have enough power to not be a typical bus going 25 miles per hour uphill, he said. The build features CB Performance Panchito heads and super push rods, AA thick wall 92mm pistons and cylinders, DeLordo 40mm carburetors, and an EPMI 90-amp alternator, custom intake, and so much more. Otter's interior received plenty of attention as well. Several methods of sound deadening material were employed throughout the bus, including ceramic insulation, retromat sound dampening, and Havelock wool insulation. The birchwood panels came from Claris Panels, as did the gray panels in the cab. Gray tweed upholstery and padding were sourced from SoFine Products. The rear seat is a custom full-width bench that also houses a diesel heater, lithium house battery, solar charger, and more. I wanted the interior as simple as possible, but to look classy, Smurthwaite said. He also created in-floor compartments just inside the cargo doors, an idea he got from Vanagon owners who used them for tools and recovery gear. The three compartments are hidden beneath the floor mat. In the cockpit, the main gauge is a GPS speedometer with a custom VW logo from Speed Hut, accompanied by a built-in tachometer. The ashtray was modified to house 12-volt accessory and USB ports. A switch panel runs all the solenoids that power the accessories Smurthwaite has installed. One switch runs power to the roof and a wireless system to run all the off-road lights. Another is for the KC Cyclone rock lights mounted to the belly pans. The last is for the winch. Smurthwaite completed the majority of the work in his own shop, Westy Restorations, which he founded in 2016. It was a dream of mine to build a car that could make it to the SEMA show after attending the show 20 years prior, Smurthwaite said. Being sponsored by AMPI helped push the bus over the goal line more quickly, with just 6 months to finish, when it was sitting on a rotisserie with the inside freshly painted. It was a long road with several custom parts to be completed. I barely pulled it off in the last week before the show. As is true with any build, there were many hands involved. I want to thank my wife for all she has done during this process, Smurthwaite said, Me being away every spare moment was not easy. I also want to thank the local VW scene and family who helped during the build and came together during the last week to help finish. Without them, I never would have made it. Along with the sponsors who sent products and were involved with the build, EMPI, Go Westy Camper Products, Retro Sound Manufacturing, A1 Performance Exhaust, Blackline Racing, and Factor 55. Their parts and work truly help make this bus what it is. Since Otter was completed, Jason has taken him on many adventures, from SEMA to a variety of events, as well as the annual Ottinger Caravan in Moab, Utah, where he showed off his off-road capabilities, handling everything the trails put in his path with ease. Future plans for Otter may include shipping to Europe for an extended family road trip, but for now, don't be surprised to see him kicking up dust in the middle of the desert or camping in the backcountry. Otter the Overlander is ready for anything.
The adventure is calling. Are you ready to answer? Front Runner Outfitters equips explorers, overlanders, and outdoor enthusiasts with rugged gear that takes you far beyond the beaten path. From durable roof racks to clever storage solutions and all the accessories you need, Front Runner Outfitters has you covered. Every product is built tough, tested in the wild, and ready to handle your next journey no matter where it leads. It's time to pack up and live your adventure. Explore our full lineup at frontrunneroutfitters.com.
Gearing Up, the history and how-to of Ural's world-class side hack. Words by Bill Dragoo. Photos by Susan Dragoo. The 1960 BMW R60/2 is one of my favorite motorcycles of all time. It is simple, robust, easy to work on, and it draws a crowd everywhere it goes. It embodies the essence of a motorcycle, and its infectious personality is a quickly acquired blood-borne illness, a welcome affliction indeed. Imitation is the sincerest form of flattery. The 2024 Ural Gear Up is a fair representation of my old BMW. Not surprising, actually, since the Ural's Russian makers, quote, borrowed its design from a late 1930s BMW R71. The Red Army needed an agile machine, durable enough to carry military loads and personnel quickly over rough terrain to answer the fast-paced warfare of Germany. And so, in 1940, the Russian military, under Joseph Stalin, ordered the production of a new motorcycle based on the BMW. The Soviets purchased five R71s through a third party in Sweden and reverse-engineered to replicate their enemy's somewhat balky but beautiful bike, trike, since it was designed to tow a sidecar. Initially dubbed the M71, the early Ural's designation was soon upgraded to M72. The name Ural was adopted later, an appropriate moniker, when the factory moved from Moscow to a brewery in the town of Irbit, tucked in the Ural Mountains on the edge of Siberia, to escape the reach of German bombers. Almost 10,000 M72 motorcycles rolled out of the Irbit Motorcycle Factory, IMZ, for the war effort, and in 1953, IMZ began building civilian models. By the late 1950s, military production had moved to Kyiv, Ukraine. Almost every component originated in the plant, from rubber bits, castings, frames, and shocks to control cables, plastic pieces, and brakes. Ultimately, Ural employed some 10,000 workers, producing about 130,000 units annually. The Irbit facility began producing machines for the domestic market and became the only large-scale motorcycle manufacturer in the Soviet Union. The next 40 years saw Ural motorcycles selling in Southeast Asia, India, and Western Europe. In 1994, the independent company, Ural America, set up shop for distribution in the United States, which became their largest market. By 2023, Ural boasted 190 independent dealerships worldwide, including high-volume markets in Australia, Canada, the EU, Japan, and the United Kingdom. Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Like the lovable rattle trap of the 1968 film Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, the Ural has always been a charming machine to ride, but ownership required a deft wrench hand and a willingness to put to use by the side of the road. Almost any average mechanic could work on it, which was a blessing because Russian-built Urals were known to be unreliable, fussy, and clunky in an old truck kind of way. Castings were rough, gears loosely meshed, electrics were finicky, and materials lacked the quality of modern machinery, especially compared to the Japanese motorcycles of the 1960s and beyond. Breakdowns were common, almost an accepted part of Ural ownership. Constant, never-ending improvement was not initially part of the Ural's heritage, but by the 21st century, a focus on quality became necessary to survival. In 2006, Ural's corporate headquarters moved to Redmond, Washington. Quality has steadily improved and reliability is approaching modern expectations. Ural adopted electronic fuel injection in 2014 and 5 years later improved it for easier starting and to meet Euro 5 emissions requirements. A 2-year unlimited mileage warranty adds value and owner confidence. Urals are now built in Petropavlovsk, Kazakhstan, under great scrutiny. The Ural GearUp's traditional 740cc 41 horsepower motor received completely new precision machine castings in 2023, with a two-piece front bearing housing and rubber gaskets in critical areas where leaks were prevalent in older models. Roller lifters replaced the original flat tappet design of old, extending cam life and lengthening valve adjustment intervals. Brembo brakes now bind all three wheels. Adjustable socks, shock absorbers provide suspension, and hide-and-out tires are standard equipment. The widely spaced 4-speed gearbox, plus reverse, remains fundamentally the same, but CV joints have replaced the previous drive shaft and drive axle U-joints for a smoother, more durable transfer of power to the drive wheels. Who would bother? Riding the Urals is a horse of a different color. It is neither motorcycle nor car. Even the Kaman Spider, Polaris Slingshot, or a conventional trike handles completely different. At first blush, the Ural's steering feels heavy, and the machine seems to have a mind of its own. For someone who is married to a modern vehicle with power steering and air conditioning, plush interior, and a cushy suspension, this might feel a bit too primal. If you are addicted to the three-dimensional allure of a motorcycle, leaning into curves with the touch of a handlebar, it might feel clunky and heavy. Ural riders, sidecar drivers in general, are a rare breed. The very handling characteristics that make it strange are enduring once mastered, and they add another dimension to adventure travel. You never have to put down a foot at stop signs. Friends and strangers are wowed when you back out of a parking lot, and passengers are thrilled or terrified when you fly the chair with them inside, a feat not recommended for first dates. The sidecar is at least more comfortable than riding pillion, and the heritage of these old machines is unparalleled. Taming the beast. My wife Susan and I recently had the unique opportunity to ride a Ural in the magnificent San Juan Mountains of Colorado. Our experience was one of the more memorable outings we've had in a long time. Initially, some accused the beast of trying to kill them. This really isn't fair unless you've spent enough time in the saddle to learn the physics of a completely different kind of transportation, one most people will never experience. The tendency on right turns for the car to fly or lift off the ground forces the driver to widen the turn radius or slow down to prevent upsetting the whole kit and caboodle. I can relate as on two occasions I crossed the center line when I felt the car lifting on a right-hand turn at some speed. I quickly backed off the throttle, which yanked the bars left, putting me in harm's way against traffic. Thankfully, there was no traffic at the time. It wasn't long before I had explored the nature of the machine enough to learn the critical point of no return and could stay within the envelope or lift the wheel at will. I also discovered that by extending my vision farther down the road and riding more conservatively than on a standard two-wheeler, I could prevent those whoopsies that lead to unplanned changes of underwear. Adding my wife to the sidecar also helped minimize aerial acrobatics. Although her added weight made it more difficult to fly the chair, the consequences also helped keep us grounded mostly. Shift and wiggle. When shifting, the Ural does a little wiggle dance unless you are ahead of the machine. This typically happens when accelerating or on extended climbs like Monarch Pass, where high power settings are interrupted by quickly squeezing and releasing the clutch. There's a yawing moment, or tendency to turn left when braking or depowering. It is caused by the inertia of the sidecar against the motorcycle portion of the rig. Acceleration and deceleration forces act against the rear drive wheel, which is placed roughly 4 feet left of the car's wheel, and make the rig pivot accordingly. A strong hand is required to keep the bike steady when riding this way. It would amount to two skaters holding hands, the one on the left suddenly rolling over carpet while the other is still on a hard surface. When the skater on the carpet slows, they will sling the free-rolling skater to the left. The opposite happens when the other skater rolls over the carpet. Hence, when shifting, acceleration is interrupted by sudden engine braking and another acceleration as the clutch is re-engaged. Smooth operation is well rewarded. The gentle way. These tendencies aren't difficult to mitigate once the rider retrains their habits to address the lateral forces before they occur. This can be done in two primary ways. When shifting, first roll back slightly on the throttle to balance any forward pull or acceleration. Ease in the clutch, shift, then ease it back out again while gently rolling on the throttle. The rig might tug a little to one side or the other, but very mildly by comparison. Treat it nicely, and it will respond accordingly. Some like it rough. Don't fight the rig. Instead, when riding more aggressively, especially on flat gravel with good sight distance, use the yawing tendency to your advantage to initiate a turn. For example, if you're approaching a left turn, roll in at some speed, then roll off the throttle just as you initiate the turn. The motorcycle will effortlessly ease into the turn with little further input from the rider. If a tighter turn is desired, simply tap the rear brake and the rear tires will begin to slide out or drift, pointing the rig deeper into the turn. This is called oversteer. The skid is not hard to control if you ease into it gradually, and the fun factor is off the scale. You will be bootlegging turns in minutes. For right turns, as long as the road tapers gently toward the shoulder or ditch, you can use the car's wheel to scribe a lower pathway than the wheels on the motorcycle. The open view turns on Owl Creek Pass near Ridgeway, Colorado, were the perfect playground for this kind of riding. Simply drop the wheel into the groove and let her rip. The motorcycle and sidecar would track like a slot car on right turns, and the car's usual tendency to lift was offset by the camber of the road. If you reduce power, however, the rig will understeer, making it harder to turn, so it is best to stay on the gas. These are just a couple of techniques for riding the Ural or any sidecar rig. Use moderation as you explore the possibilities, and don't push your limits except when conditions are right to do so. Experts and lifelong side hack riders can perform incredible stunts and tricks far beyond these. But with a little practice, the old BMW knockoff can be a blast to ride, and you will make new friends at every gas stop. The history and handling and overall experience of a Ural isn't for everyone, but those with a strong spirit of adventure will find it a unique way to explore the backroads and trails of the American West and beyond.
Field review of the 2025 Oregon Trailer Teardrop Alpha. Oregon Trailer's flagship off-road teardrop is a fine tow for overlanding couples, by Bruce W. Smith. One primary feature of overlanding is having the ability to camp comfortably off-grid for days at a time while keeping the ecological footprint as small as possible. My wife and I had the opportunity to spend a few days in a great camp trailer that's been a standout in this category for more than a decade. Oregon Trailer's Teardrop Alpha. The TDA is the flagship among five models built in-house by the small, family-run RV manufacturer in Eugene, Oregon. It is a strong, extremely well-crafted camp trailer with independent suspension, tons of custom features, and a dry weight of just 1,600 pounds, which means it can be towed by many of today's popular all-wheel drive crossovers and mid-size SUVs. We hitched it to a 2024 Ford Bronco Raptor while camping and exploring the back roads in Oregon's Coast Range. All of our trailers are essentially built like giant custom cabinets that are covered with an armor-like blend of Platinum Linex Bedliner coating, says founder and co-owner John Christensen. We use only the best Baltic birch wood, the best waterproof glues, and cover all seams and end grains, edges, with penetrating epoxy just like it's done in the sailboat industry. To us, one of the most important aspects of overlanding camper production is waterproofing inside and out. This 13-foot trailer's 8-foot long by 5-foot width by 4-foot height insulated body has a queen bed sleeping space filled with two thick cushions that provide excellent sleeping comfort. Additionally, the cabin is fitted with an array of cubbies, racks, and storage cabinets, 12-volt, 120-volt plug-ins and charging outlets, a 3-speed ceiling fan, and adjustable LED lighting. The trailer's 12-volt electrical system is powered by a deep cycle AGM battery and controlled by a 4000 series Progressive Dynamics power center. Multiple battery and solar upgrades are available. Oregon Trailer has also done a great job designing the galley under the rear hatch. The hatch is supported by a pair of robust springs and lifts high to provide unabated access to the upper shelf while protecting the work area from direct exposure to falling rain. The hatch also has triple seals that keep dust out when traveling dusty back roads. The TDA comes in 4 trim levels: base, standard, deluxe, and custom. The deluxe model, $35,000 as tested, we camped in for several days, came equipped with a portable Camp Chef Mountain Series 2-burner stove, fed off a 16-ounce gas bottle, both of which store in the large space under the Formica counter. It also sported side awnings and a waterport 8-gallon solar shower on the roof rack. Overall, Oregon Trailer's TerraDrop Alpha Deluxe is a great choice for overlanding because it has a long list of customizable options for specific needs. Plus, it's a trailer built in the Pacific Northwest that can be passed on to the next generation of overlanders. Oh, and did I mention Oregon Trailer has a rental program through which you can pick up a TerraDrop Alpha direct from the company's facility to try before you buy? If you'd like to learn more, you can visit Oregon Trailer's website at OregonTrailerQuotes.net. As an aside, we had the joy of towing the TerraDrop Alpha behind Ford's 2024 Bronco 4-door Raptor, priced at $90,035. This top-tier Bronco is one of the best short-wheelbase 4x4s on the market. The Raptor is capable of traversing the most demanding off-road trails and backcountry conditions most overland adventurers would ever encounter. Ford's premium Bronco model has a 4,500-pound tow rating and a 413-horsepower 3-liter EcoBoost V6 mated to a 10-speed automatic. It pulled the TDA without the slightest hesitation. If you're serious about off-roading, boondocking, and camping off-grid, it'd be really hard to beat a Bronco Raptor.
This audio edition of Outdoor by Four is brought to you by Radius Outfitters. We all know how messy life and vehicles can get. That's why Radius offers rugged storage systems that protect and organize your essentials. From customizable storage boxes to kitchen organizers, Radius gear makes life at camp easier so you'll be ready for anything. Whether cruising with the family in the desert or kicking it solo in the mountains. Check them out today by visiting RadiusOutfitters.com.
Stay tuned for Outdoor by Four's issue 54, highlighting a myriad of stories that'll inspire you to step out and explore the world around you. Also, be sure to visit the Outdoor by Four website at OutdoorX4.com regularly for new tips, reviews, and stories, and join our e-newsletter to stay in the loop on the latest from Outdoor by Four. You can also follow Outdoor by Four and the adventures of our staff and contributors on Instagram and Facebook at @OutdoorX4, on TikTok and YouTube at @OutdoorX4 Magazine, and by following the hashtag OutdoorX4. Until our next issue, we wish each of you the happiest of adventures.